There are any number of reasons you might consider selling your home. To move closer to family, live within a smaller budget, or just wanting a change of scenery. Whatever your reasons, having to figure out all the various housing market trends in your area may not be what you signed up for. That's where an agent who is a Realtor comes in. Realtors have the expertise to help you find the right price and navigate the process to sell your home in a way that's right for you. That's who we are. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
You and Betty and the Nancys and Bills and Joes and Janes will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.
Welcome to Inquiring Minds. I'm Indre Viscontis. This is a podcast that explores the space where science and society collide. We want to find out what's true, what's left to discover, and why it matters. This week, we're sharing with you a special episode. It was a collaboration we did with the Society for the Neuroscience of Creativity. Yep, such a society exists. There are people who are looking at the brain basis of what makes us creative. And I'm lucky enough to be one of the collaborators of that organization. During our annual meeting, we had the pleasure of programming food science writer Kenji Lopez-Ault in a live conversation with our members. It was a joy to talk to Kenji. And if you're not familiar with his work, check out The Food Lab, in which he takes a scientific approach to cooking. And he's got a new book out called The Wok, which I have to say describes uses of a kitchen utensil that I never reach for. But apparently, he does all the time. So here's my conversation with Kenji. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Crosstalk, presented by the Society for the Neuroscience of Creativity and co-produced by Inquiring Minds. My name is Indre Viscontis. I'm the host of Inquiring Minds and the president-elect of the Society for the Neuroscience of Creativity. And I'm so excited to present this Crosstalk event with legendary chef, food scientist, all of the above, author Kenji Lopez-Ault. Welcome.
All right. How are you doing?
Good, good.
Although I'm technically neither a scientist, because I'm not really a scientist, and I'm not even a chef anymore because I don't have any anymore. So.
Okay, well, how do you label yourself? I mean,
writer, yeah.
Writer. Okay, great.
Food science writer.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your journey, because you started out, as far as I understand, in an architecture degree at MIT.
Yes. I ended up with an architecture degree at MIT.
Oh, okay. Okay, great.
I started out in the biology program and then stopped doing that after taking organic chemistry. and then realizing, and not everything about biology is going to be what I enjoy about biology. And it also made me realize that I actually really did not like lab work. And I'd worked in labs for a couple summers through school, and lab work I did not enjoy. And you got to do a lot of lab work in when you're in biology. And so that sort of made me think I need to rethink my career choice here.
So what didn't you like about lab work?
The pace, mainly, that, reading and learning biology, it's like you can read and learn very fast, but to do actual experiments takes a long time and a lot of planning. And I don't mind doing long, I don't mind planning and doing hard work and spending a long time working on something, but it has to be something where I'm not just interested in the result, but I'm also, actively enjoying the process. And unfortunately, pipetting and running PCR machines and stuff, the process was not something I enjoyed.
How does that compare to prepping ingredients for, when you're cooking?
I mean, so prepping ingredients can also be, some people don't like that, right? It's like, I went into restaurant, that summer, I started cooking because that's the summer after my sophomore year, which is when I sort of had this thought that I don't want to do biology. Instead of working in a biology lab, I ended up landing a job in a kitchen just randomly. I'd never really cooked before. Somebody offered me a job cooking for the summer. So, you know, working in a kitchen can actually, I think a lot of people would find it mind numbing as well. You know, some of my early restaurant jobs, it's like every single morning I would go in and for an hour I would sit there peeling and then chopping citrus zest, right? Because mm-hmm. we would do this like powdered citrus zest over a bunch of different dishes. And so I just sit there with a knife, just chop for like an hour. And so that, you know, that I think some people would find that mind numbing, but I actually, for some reason, like that kind of work just kind of clicked with me. And also like, you know, I enjoyed sort of setting up challenges for myself. It's like the first day I did it, it took me like 3 hours to do, you know, and then like a few months in, I realized like, oh, instead of one knife, I can take a rubber band and tie the handles of three knives together and then bounce them all together. And it goes three times as fast. And then I just get more fit. My muscles get better at it also. So you can cut down like a 3 hour project into 35 minutes and you feel like that's a valuable use of three months of work to and it's also, you know, I think kitchens, I think are just more, for me at least, are, I could sit there and chop onions for a very long time, much longer than I can.
Really?
Getting bored of it. And I don't know, you tell me, it's just the way my brain is wired.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, I won't presume to know anything about, you know, your brain wiring, but I do think that there is a cultural side to it too, though. I think that a lot of times, you know, the seriousness of the work that happens in science tends to make lab environments very quiet, you know, just like not having a lot of joy and fun. Whereas I think like in the kitchen, maybe if like the ultimate goal is to, you know, create a great experience for the customer, maybe there's more of a push towards like having cool music in the kitchen or
there's cool music sometimes, but a lot of kitchens are also very, you know, there's various types of kitchens, but most kitchens are pretty also very focused, you know, because you're working on really tight deadlines and there's a lot of pressure. And so most of the time, like in a kitchen, like at least any well-run kitchen, people are going to have their heads down working hard. And so there's a lot of sort of intense focus and adrenaline that goes on. And then, of course, like, you know, in the old days and still to some degree now, you know, kitchens are also had this sort of like abusiveness to them. So that wasn't fun.
You know what? Yeah, there's a lot of
verbal abuse is not fun. And that happens a lot in kitchens.
Yeah, I don't know how much verbal abuse happens in labs, but there's certainly bad behavior that happens in labs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've heard stories of, bad behavior, I think, happens anywhere where there's power dynamics at play.
All right. So you spent this summer working in this restaurant, and you have this chemistry background also in your family, right? I mean, there's like
my grandfather's organic chem is an organic chemist. Actually it was like one of his colleagues taught the class that I hated. But my grandfather is an organic chemist and my father is a biologist. So yeah, so and we lived in the same. So my grandparents lived on 9J, and we lived in 10J, the same apartment. And so we have, you know, meals together, and so, you know, just around the dinner table, it's like whenever my grandfather and my father were in the same room, then like all conversation was just science all the time. So it was kind of one of the languages spoken in my family growing up. So something that I always had an interest in beyond just school.
So then, how did architecture fit in?
I mean, essentially after that summer, I continued to cook. I mean, I loved cooking, so I continued to cook part-time while I was in school. And then, you know, I kind of shopped around and I was like, maybe I'll do computer science. Yeah, I did all the sort of basic courses in like computer science and mechanical engineering and physics. And then and architecture was one I just thought like, seems like it could be fun. And it turned out it was fun. Yeah. So I started architecture and then finished in architecture. Spent the rest of my time focusing. I had to like make up a bunch of credits because I started it late and everyone in my class was like the year below me, but I finished it.
And so like, you know, that education in architecture, how did that influence your later career trajectory?
Well, you know, people ask this a lot. I mean, I don't know that the specific education in architecture had a huge impact. You know, there are definitely parallels in architecture and food. In that both of them are these things that on one hand are, you know, are purely functional because we need to live in spaces, we need to eat food. And they're things that everybody, you know, that things that everybody does. But on the other hand, there's this sort of, you know, artistic side to it and creative side to it. And so it's one of the few things, like even more so than say music or visual arts, you know, where people have to live somewhere and people have to eat, right? And so in that sense, like you as an architect or a chef, you're forced not just to contend with the sort of artistic merits of something, but also the functional aspects of something. And so you have to think about both those things. And so in that sense, I think architecture and food are related because they both have this idea of functionality and form, creativity that have to be sort of balanced out and have to work together. But I would say it was more just the sort of the general science and engineering background you get from going to a school like MIT that I think has influenced my career more, just the, as far as the way I think about food and the way I try and teach people how to cook is very, very much focused in those sort of like first elements, you know, ideas of learning the basics and learning the science behind it and building up from there.
Yeah. So it seems as an outsider, when I look at sort of the culture of cooking, there seems to be some dominion of celebrity chefs or, you know, people who are in the know, or like people like Julia Child, who maybe aren't overtly like glamorous and famous to begin with, but they have this authority that they have, that they kind of like, here's a cookbook, here's a recipe, here's how to do something. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about to what extent this kind of authoritative looking down, you know, differs or influences, or like, you know, your approach of taking more of a scientific look, like, okay, what is actually the best way to make a chocolate chip cookie? Like, this is an empirical question and why, as opposed to like, I'm Jamie Oliver and I'm going to bake this cookie from, you know.
Right. Well, so, you know, I try not to say, so I do have recipes that have titles like, you know, the best chocolate chip cookie or whatever.
You do.
I try not to use that terminology anymore, mainly because I feel like it sort of got misinterpreted from what, from the way I used it. You know, I did that. So I came from, you know, I worked at Cooks Illustrated for, they had that sort of, that naming style. And then when I went to Serious Eats, I kind of did it in a sort of tongue in cheek way, like, you know, whatever is, you know, it is partly that, it's also partly like, people click on things that say best, whatever. And at that time, we'd made our revenue on clicks and we had payroll and all this stuff that we had to do. So we had to get people to click somehow. But the general rule we had at Serious Eats, at least, and when I'm writing like a food lab article, is that when we call something best, what we really mean is like, in this article, we're going to show you all of the different factors that go into, say, making beef stew or making a chocolate chip cookie or making fried chicken. And we're going to show you all the different variables and all the things you can change, and how each changing each one of those things is going to affect the outcome. And so while I'm going to present you with one single chocolate chip cookie recipe that I'm going to say, this is the best chocolate chip cookie recipe, what I really mean by best is that if you read this whole article and you follow along on the testing, then you're going to be armed with the knowledge of how to make your own version of, you know, whatever is best to you. So it's not, I'm not saying like this particular cookie is empirically the best cookie. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that everybody has a particular idea of what is best. And, you know, maybe that idea of what's best changes over time. It's like, you don't have to always have the exact same chocolate chip cookie, right? It's like what I'm in the mood for today, I might not be in the mood for tomorrow. But if I've done all this testing on chocolate chip cookies and I know that, like, you know, using a higher ratio of brown sugar to white sugar is going to make the cookie moister, or if I melt the butter before adding it, it's going to make the cookie spread more and get like a lacier edge. Like, knowing those things is going to allow me to modify the recipe so that I can get it towards a result that I would consider best at that moment for myself. And so that's really what I mean in those articles when I say best. And that, of course, that's not how it necessarily gets interpreted, right? Some people will say, oh, he said it's best, but I don't think that's best. It's like, that's fine. You don't have to think it's best. But it's, you know, it's hard to express all his ideas without being able to sit there and explain to someone exactly what you meant, you know, and people online like to be offended by things, like to express opinions. So
Yeah.
Can't really help that.
That's absolutely true. You know, one of the things that hearing you talk about this, it reminds me too of a lot of the struggles that people who study creativity come along with, which is the sense that a creativity researcher believes that it is important to understand how creativity works and, you know, what's happening in the brain when people are being creative under different conditions and how can we enhance it. And there's a whole, you know, slew of individuals too who think that, well, you can never really demystify creativity. You need to leave some things unanswered. It's never going to be, you're never going to quite get what you need. So I wondered if you ever have had this encounter where there is this push and pull between understanding why you in a recipe would suggest to do this things and, you know, either use the tools that you're using or the ingredients or in this order, and how that kind of relates to the sort of like, should there be some mystery in cooking, right? Like that there's just some like, you know, like a magician who never gives up all of their secrets. Like, is there ever that tension?
Oh, that there should be like a secret ingredient? I mean,
Yeah, or like that people are like, well, Kenji's not really, you know, it's like they might not trust what you say so much because you're showing exactly why you think each
right.
step is out of the way, as opposed to like, well, just trust me, I know.
I mean, the reason I don't say just trust me, I know, is because I hate when people do that to me. It's like, I'm the kind of person who wants to take apart the toaster oven and see what's going on inside it, you know? But creativity for me, it's like, I studied a lot of music when I was younger, particularly composition, right? And so if you look at like old manuscripts by like Mozart versus Beethoven, right? They're both extremely creative people, but they had very different processes. Whereas like, you know, like you look at a Mozart manuscript, it's like, this guy wrote the thing. He came up with it in his head. He wrote it once. Nothing's erased. Nothing's crossed out. It's just like it came from his mind, fully formed, and he put it on the paper. And there it is, right? Whereas like, if you look at like a Beethoven manuscript, it's like things are scratched out until there's like holes in the paper because he goes back and forth and really works on a single idea. And so, you know, for me, like I'm more the type that when I'm writing or when I'm coming up with a recipe, I write a ton. Like I write thousands and thousands, like even my children's book, which ended up being, I can't remember, a few hundred words. I wrote like tens of thousands of words for that. And then I edit and edit and edit until I get it the way I want it. And so, yeah, I'm much more of this sort of tinker type of creative where it's like, I get as many ideas as I can out there. And then I decide for myself, which ones are good and which ones are bad. And I think, you know, honestly, like having a medium, like, you know, like Serious Eats, a blog, you know, where it's like, I'm writing and publishing like 5 to 6 articles a week. That's actually like a very, it was a good medium for me to learn how to write in, because, you know, that's essentially where I sort of learned how to write in my voice and how to come up with ideas. And it's a really good medium because it's like, there's this constant fire hose of stuff coming out and that people don't always expect everything to be perfect. And the good stuff sticks and the bad stuff, you can work on it, right? But it's something that forces you to write every day. And so what, you know, whether it's cooking or writing or whatever, I think just doing it all the time, even if every single idea is not a good one, just by the sheer act of doing so much of it, you're bound to come up with some good ideas now and then. And those are the ones that are going to end up sort of sticking and informing your future decisions. So I'm not sure I exactly understood the setup of your question, but for me, the process of creativity is really about doing as much as I possibly can and then editing it and hoping that that occasionally something, you know, one of those 100 ideas is a good one, and not caring if the other 99 aren't.
Well, despite my ill-asked question, I feel like you actually touched on something that a lot of creativity researchers are nodding their heads and saying that's exactly right. And that is that so often we think of creativity as being one spontaneous aha moment. But when you look at the actual process, when you interview creatives, what you hear is exactly what you're describing, which is, I had 1,000 ideas before I had the one good idea.
Right. You know. An example I can give is, you know, in my book, I had this recipe for this potato gratin, where the idea was, instead of stacking the potatoes, layering them like shingles, you stand them up on their edge so that they're fanned out, right? And so when you bake this, and then you do it in like a normal gratin, like cream, a little bit of cheese, garlic, thyme, salt and pepper, milk, and then you bake it. But as you bake it, like the top edges of the potatoes kind of dry out and turn crispy like potato chips. And, you know, the way I wrote it is like, and this sort of was how it happened, where it's like, it was late at night and I was like, oh, it's November, we need a potato recipe. Hey, wait a minute. Like, what if I just tilt the potatoes on their sides? You know, and I woke up, my wife was like, I had this great idea for this potato thing. She's like, yeah, that's great. Show me tomorrow. It felt like a spontaneous idea at the moment. But the only reason I had that idea is because I've made like a million potato recipes and I kind of know how potatoes work. So there's all this stuff already swimming in my head. And then at the time, it's like Hasselback potatoes, you know, where you take a potato and you kind of cut almost all the way through it and then you bake it at the edge.
Yeah.
And that, like, that was like this like kind of meme going around the internet for a while, like this popular recipe. So it's like, I obviously had this idea of like these flaky potato upright things, and then just combine that with the idea of a potato gratin, which is like a classic holiday dish. And then I looked it up. I was like, has nobody done this before? And I looked up and I tried to find books. I tried to find recipes on the internet. It seemed like nobody had done it before. So I was like, oh, that's an original idea. People are going to like this. And now when I write it, I can, you know, I can exaggerate the fact that it's just like, I made some Eddie Izzard joke about how he has a joke about how when Heimlich invents his maneuver, he wakes his wife up and I've invented a maneuver. But you know, it you can make it sound like it's this spontaneous thing, but even when it is a spontaneous thing, it's like the only reason that you can come up with ideas like that spontaneously is because you've like fed all this other information into this funnel in your head, and like something popped out the other end that happened to be good that time.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes we distinguish like what you're talking about, which sounds to me like you did a whole bunch of kind of preparation work and then you kind of incubated it on for a while. And then you had this kind of aha moment where like mm-hmm. it kind of popped up, as opposed to a more kind of step-by-step approach, which actually a lot of people following your recipes are doing, where you're slowly getting closer to the solution to a problem. And I wondered if maybe like your reverse steak, mm-hmm. you know, the reverse searing on the steak sure. idea, like did that also come to you in a moment, or was it more like a...
So that one was at Cook's Illustrated. That was actually my first article at Cook's Illustrated. I think I started working that in 2006. The assignment, the editorial assignment was just a, you know, we haven't done a pan-seared steak recipe. Kenji, like, come up with a recipe for pan-seared steak, make some pan sauces. And so that was one of those that, you know, when I was young and eager to prove myself. And so that was like, all right, like I'm going to test every single thing I can about pan-searing steak, like, you know, letting it come up to room temperature first, cooking it straight from the fridge, cooking it from frozen, cooking it in oil, cooking in butter, all these different things. You know, the reason that one came is because at that time, 2006, my last job before that was working at a restaurant, Oclea, which doesn't exist anymore, but Chef Ken Oringer. And right around then, 2004, 2005 was when sous vide machines first started getting widely used in restaurants. I mean, so I borrowed a circulator from my dad's lab, like an actual lab equipment, and brought it into the restaurant to work, because at that point there were no specifically food service sous vide machines and people were all using this kind of recycled lab equipment. So I borrowed one from my dad to do it. So we cooked a bunch of stuff sous vide at the restaurant. And so we were first learning how it worked. That was sort of fresh in my head when I came to Cook's Illustrated. And so the idea with the reverse sear was like, well, like sous vide was such a useful tool at the restaurant. And one of the useful aspects of it is that you can bring a piece of meat up to a certain temperature and not overshoot at all. Like you can guarantee that it's going to be medium rare, right? And you get this kind of nice, perfectly medium rare color from edge to edge, which was a novel thing at the time, right? And people were not used to seeing their meat like that. Usually if you ordered medium rare at a restaurant, you would get this kind of bullseye pattern where the center is medium rare and it gets progressively more cooked as you get to the edge. So it was this novel thing. And I was like, okay, like how can we adapt this idea to home cooking, which is where the idea of like starting it in a low temperature oven and then searing it. And of course, it turns out later, several years later, in fact, almost like a decade later, I don't remember exactly when, but I found out, oh, there's actually like a couple of people who were doing this or something similar to it before we published that article. So I don't want to take credit for having invented that, because there were people doing it before we published that article. But anyhow, the point was like, it was the reason I was able to come up with that idea was partly because I was very systematically, you know, I cooked, it was like over 100 different tests I did on that one pan-seared steak recipe. But the actual sort of inspiration for cooking it slowly first and finishing with a sear came directly from a technique from adapting a restaurant technique, sous vide, that I had been doing at a restaurant before that. So it was sort of like a combination of testing, but then also just like things that were in my head by virtue of having some experience, and then putting those two things together. And maybe that's sort of where creativity lies, is like putting ideas together and seeing what happens when you or being able to relate to ideas and seeing what connects them and what new things can be created out of putting those ideas together. I mean, I certainly think that's a lot of like what good writing is about. It's like connecting ideas and being able to, especially sort of, I think, scientific writing, we're writing about science for a non-science audience. A lot of that comes down to being able to relate relatively complicated scientific principles into terms that people can understand, terms that people can relate to in their everyday life, and drawing metaphors and using language that is not usually used in science to get people to glom onto it better. And I think that, you know, that's sort of, I think, what I work the hardest at as far as my job goes.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's kind of the art of science communication is figuring out how to do that and how to find the right metaphors and analogies that work for people. You know, I think that a lot of creativity measurements that we have actually try to capture this. Like we have this measurement called the remote associates test, which is very, very popular, which is this idea that like the more kind of remotely associated things are, the more creative that is. So if like you give, you know, if you ask someone to, you know, what is the best chocolate chip cookie recipe? Well, most people will give you, you know, well, you got to, you know, do this, that, and the other thing. You got to put in these ingredients. But remotely, someone might say, well, you know, you should put starch in there. And that might be like, you know, a remote association. We'd say, oh, well, that's more creative because it still makes sense. I don't know if it makes sense. I've never put starch in cookies, but you seem to like starch. So I feel like that could potentially possible. But, you know, so that you're kind of capturing something that we do struggle with, like as creativity researchers, how do you quantify that process of finding things that are associated or finding these kinds of connections amongst disparate things that other people miss?
Right.
I don't know. You have any advice for us?
I would say talking to kids a lot helps because they tend to associate things that you would never think of associating. You know, it's always like, I mean, yeah, I have a five, you have an 8-year-old and a 3-year-old. I have a 5-year-old. My 9-month-old is not doing that yet, but like my 5-year-old is always saying like the craziest things and connecting these weird things that you would never think. I remember one day she came home and, and I asked her if she wanted any hummus. And she's like, no, I don't like hummus. And she's like, wait, you mean hummus with chickpeas or hummus like the tank engine? And I was like,
oh, that is so cute.
And so now we every time we talk about hummus, we talk about hummus, the tank kitchen. It's like funny connections that like about like words that you never think would be associated with each other, right? Concepts that you never think would be associated with each other. Kids have a really good way of doing that. But you know, I find that at least when I'm in a sort of creative rut or when I feel like I can't write, you know, which happens a lot, there's usually two things which help. One of them is just like forcing myself to sit down and write whatever. And oftentimes, like if it's a specific story, what I will do is I'll just start from the middle. It's like, I'm working on this piece for the New York Times about growing corn. It's like, I don't know how I'm going to introduce this story because like everybody writes about growing corn every summer, right? So I don't know what interesting thing to say at the beginning, but I do know like what's specific about the technique I'm using. So I'm just going to start, imagine that the first three paragraphs are already written and just jump right in and start writing. And then usually what I find is that one of the paragraphs I end up writing would actually be very good as the first paragraph. And sometimes what I find is like, if I do start at the beginning, just cutting off the very first paragraph I wrote and starting from the second paragraph is usually a more compelling story anyway. That's part of my editing process. Just get it out there. But the other thing I find when I'm in a creative rut is that just not writing at all and just taking like a long bath and reading a lot and like consuming things that other people have done that I enjoy, whether it's like going back and reading, and especially if it's like non-food related, you know, just books that I enjoy, novels or the things that I've enjoyed reading in the past, rereading them will often remind me, oh, like this is what I enjoy reading about this person's work. Or like, this is the kind of thing I find funny. And that helps you, I think.
That's really great advice. And it reminds me of something Ernest Hemingway once said, some advice that he was giving about how to you know, combat writer's block, which is to always end the day knowing what's going to happen next in your novel. So like most of us kind of like write until we get everything out and then we have no more ideas. And the next morning we're staring at the blank page once again.
Right.
He was like, look, just leave something in the cup so that when you sit down the next morning, you know exactly what's, you know, you're already getting going, which I thought was really interesting. And it kind of relates to what you're doing. Like you're starting in the middle so that you don't spend too much time with that awful blank page.
Right. I get the same way about housework. Like, so my wife and I take very different approaches to housework, especially like home improvement projects, like where I'm the kind of person where it's like, all right, here's this big long list of things that needs to be done. I'm just going to jump in and do the one that seems most appealing for me to do right now. I'll get it done. Like, I know I'm going to go into it with like gusto. I'll do it passionately. I'll get it done quickly and well, and then I'll think about what I'm going to do next. Whereas my wife likes to sort of, this is what we're doing day one, day two, and plan out day by day. So it's like, it's very conflicting style. And I'm not saying like one is better than the other. It's just, I think you kind of have to know what gets you going and what works best for you.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know, with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know, kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So one of the questions from our audience, Alex Levitin, is saying that the food lab changed the way that their household cooks and also looks at science, which is kind of amazing and awesome. And they ask, how do the exactitudes of science and architecture support the inexactitude creative processes and your creativity?
I'll try and answer for both, but I'll focus more on the cooking. But some people think that there's a sort of dichotomy between, you know, science and art or science and creativity. And I don't think they're at odds at all. You know, like I consider science a tool, you know, and so it's like knowing how something works doesn't mean that it only works one way. And it's sort of like if you think about like a musician, right? You know, a jazz musician who's trying to improvise, like, yeah, there's a lot of creativity in improvising. But as any good jazz musician will tell you, like, you have to practice your scales. You have to practice like your finger shapes. You have to practice your movement. You have to get the technical aspects built into you. And then only then can you use them to express your creativity. So for me, it's like with cooking, it's like the better you know technique and the more you understand how things interact with each other, those are not restrictive things. Those are actually freeing things, because then it allows you so that whatever you have in your head, it's much easier for you to get out onto the plate if you know how things are going to act. And so in many ways, I find that understanding, and it's the same in architecture, right? It's like there is a degree of freedom to just being able to sit down at a drafting table and draw whatever you want and come up with these wacky ideas. But then I think the real creativity comes when you try and mold those wacky, crazy ideas through a lens of understanding structures and understanding how people move through buildings and understanding how things support each other and refining those ideas into something that works. And I think that intersection between the functionality and the real physical aspects of it and like the creative ideas is what makes like good architecture beautiful. And the same with food. It's like you can admire a piece of food for the creativity of the flavors that go into it or the ideas in it, but those things are all supported by the technique that goes into it and by, and you know, when someone's a very good craftsman and has practiced hard at it, whether they understand like the specific science behind it or not, you can get a understanding of the functional elements of it by just doing it a lot, by cooking a lot, right? And so you can tell when someone is both creative and also a very good craftsman. And it's hard to tell if someone's creative if they can't express their creation, right? In order to be able to express your creation, you have to have that craft behind you.
So Food Lab is a book that puts you onto the stage, but, you know, came out of also a very successful blog, as you were describing. And I think it really introduced a lot of people to this notion that it doesn't need to be scary to infuse science in your cooking, that's something that, you know, is accessible to everyone, which I think a lot of us scientists really are excited to see. And I think that's a huge influence that you've made, as Alex suggests, that science in general doesn't have to be inaccessible to people. And then in April 2020, I believe, you started Kenji's cooking show.
Right.
And so I want to talk a little bit about sort of what was the idea behind that. One of the things I love about Kenji's cooking show, for people who haven't seen it yet, is you basically, you know, Kenji says hello in the beginning, and then you see what he's doing through a GoPro on his head. So I'm assuming you got your GoPro there. And so it's like,
I got one of these and I just put this on my head like that.
That's what it looks like. Yeah. Yep. And, it's like remarkably casual. Like the one that I watched most recently as I was, you know, looking through some of the recipes in the wok was, which we'll talk about it in a minute too. I wanted to watch you produce a recipe that I wouldn't traditionally think of as one that would be used in a wok. So I watched where you made spaghetti with garlic and oil, like a kind of what seemed to me a pretty traditional Italian recipe. Here you're using like a very non-Italian instrument. And one of my favorite parts at the end was like when you give your dog a piece of banana because he can't have or she can't have
garlic.
Anyway, but that's like watching you do this and it, you make it seem so easy and so accessible. And yet you seem to also have a particular reason for everything that you're doing. Like, for example, how much salt to put into the water, to use a saute pan to boil the water in the pasta, as opposed to what most of us do, which is this like massive deep pan. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about, like, I do want to talk about that particular, like just that approach and how it relates to the wok, but just tell us a little bit about how Kenji's cooking show started and were you surprised by his
You know, for a long time, we started doing recipes at Serious Eats in 2008 or 2009. Mm-hmm. And at that time, video was not a big thing, right? YouTube, I think it started in like 2007, but it, you know, it wasn't a big thing. But then, you know, sometime around like 2012 or 13, we were like, you know, video is going to be the thing. Like blogs are cool right now. That's okay. It's getting traffic, but videos are going to be the thing. I think everybody saw the wind kind of blowing that way. And so we started thinking about like ways we could do video. And, you know, and I try, especially like food lab contests, like how does this translate to video? And, you know, in many ways, I think I was kind of restricted by the idea that it had to be this like polished, produced thing. And so, you know, we tried that various ways. Like we spent $50,000 hiring a full film crew and shot like a 6-episode miniseries based on the food lab that was scripted and had a co-host. And then we shot a bunch of stuff in-house that was all scripted. And then, you know, eventually when I moved to California, I started doing stuff with like multiple cameras and scripts. And then, I very quickly realized like, well, not very quickly, but over the course of a few years, I realized like I'm terrible at scripted stuff. Like I just sound totally unnatural when I'm reading a script. So like I'm good at writing, but I'm not very good at just speaking. So the idea behind just sticking a GoPro on my head, that actually came because I, it was late one night and I had come home from a vacation in Mexico where I had bought a GoPro so that I could shoot, you know, snorkeling stuff.
That's why I bought mine, you know, scuba diving.
And the GoPro was on my desk, which is in the kitchen. And I was going to make a grilled cheese or something. And I was like, oh, like, what if I just stick the GoPro on my head and make the grilled cheese? You know, that movie, I think it was called Hardcore Harry or Hardcore Henry or something like that. It was a movie that looked like a video game that came out it was, I don't know, 2015, 14 or something like that. All shot first person style. And that movie had just come out. So I was like, oh, like people are into this first person thing. Maybe like, what if I put a camera on my head and did it? And so I did that just for fun. It was with an older GoPro, so no like image stabilization or anything, really jittery. But I put that up on YouTube. And then over the next couple of years, I just did it a couple more times just for fun. And I never really paid attention to who was watching it or what was going on with it. And then, yeah, like March of 2020, I was just looking at my YouTube channel. I was like, oh, this video has like a million views. And it was just me making a grilled cheese like 4 years ago, whatever it was. Maybe I'll try doing some more like that. And so, so I got a better camera and I stuck it on my head. And at that point, you know, by that point, my book had come out, and I had gotten actually quite used to, you know, I've never been, when I was younger, at least I'd never been very good at talking in front of crowds. I get stage fright, I get nervous talking in front of large crowds, but it was one of these things where it's like you practice it and get better and better at it. So my book came out and I went on book tour. And so I got used to talking in front of crowds. I got used to like teaching demos, especially like cooking and talking while I was cooking and showing people what I was doing. And then also, you know, when you do live demos, you're always making mistakes. And so you have to be able to talk about why this mistake happened and just roll with it. And so I had this kind of like practice doing that and it's kind of banter already set up. And so the parts that made me nervous about being on camera, which is like having a camera pointed in my face and having to talk to it from a script, by sticking the camera in my own head so that people weren't looking at me and they were focusing really on the food, I could just pretend I was showing a friend or showing an live audience and talk through what I was cooking. And that's really how I thought of it. It's just like, I'm just pretend I'm doing a live demo, which essentially is what I am doing. It's going to be casual. People understand that it's live. So it's okay to have mistakes in it. And, that was sort of the formula. It was sort of like the anti-cooking show thing where it's like, it's just about the food. It's not really about you don't really see me in it much. It's not scripted. I don't plan what I'm doing ahead of time. So like oftentimes you'll see like I don't have the exact right ingredients for a recipe. And I think it ends up being actually like a very good compliment for the book, because the book seems like this very precise thing. It's like you need this exact list of 40 ingredients or whatever. But, you know, what I try to show in the show is like, hey, like I'm a normal person with a normal house. There's 5 family members here. There's dogs. Like it's always a mess because I have 2 kids. And like my wife and I have different ideas of kitchen organizations, that things are all over the place. Like this is how most people live. And so I think showing how like understanding these principles of cooking and how they can apply to a chaotic everyday life and how they can actually help you navigate that in the kitchen, I think is what has become attractive.
And people don't, it's massively successful. I mean, you really, it's like the anti-cooking show that like beat out all the cooking shows out there. And it's sort of like out Jamie Olivering Jamie Oliver.
Well, I don't know.
That it's like one of my favorite moments is where like you're like looking for an instrument and you like pull out a drawer and it's like the drawer is a mess and you're like, where's that? Oh, here it is. And then it's like, yeah, now I feel like I can pick up that cookbook, The Wok, and do whatever it is in there, because I watch you do this one recipe in it. And when I just see it on the page, it feels like, oh, this is going to be a lot of work and going to be hard. And then just watching you do it, I was like, oh, I can totally do that. And so let me talk, can I talk about like a couple of little specific things? One, it seems like you use a lot of salt, especially in that recipe.
Okay.
And I wonder if you could, and I know that this is true of chefs in general, but I wonder if you ever think about like, what is the science behind using a lot of salt in recipes? Why is it that it makes things more flavorful? And why is it such a like universal tool? And do we have to worry about it ultimately in terms of how it affects our health?
I mean, the reason it makes foods taste good is because it literally like opens up neural pathways that help you taste things better, right? So it's like if you eat a tomato with no salt on it, it tastes fine. But then you put salt on it, it does, even just like a teeny pinch of salt, not enough to make it taste salty. It'll just taste more like a tomato, right? Because it allows your tongue to perceive these things better. So in that sense, you know, yeah, salt is the reason, you know, and also the reason chefs use a lot of salt. Is partly because, especially like, you know, I had a beer hall. And so it's like, you use as much salt as you can without making foods taste like out of this world salty, because people order beer when they're thirsty.
Yeah,
and salt tastes good, right? That's part of what makes restaurant food taste better than home cooked, is because it's seasoned up to the edge of where it becomes unpalatable. You know, and I think there probably is something to the idea that chefs like over time lose sensitivity to it. So things that seem reasonably well seasoned to a normal person might seem under seasoned to me. The health thing, I'm not a nutritionist, so I can't really answer. From what I gather, most people are fine with, you know, it's like talk to your doctor. Some people are very sensitive to salt. Some people have specific health reasons they need to limit their salt intake, but most people just pee it out. You're probably fine unless you have high blood pressure or some other issue that you're dealing with. And, you know, for me, it's like, I feel like if you're cooking at home and you're generally cooking from scratch and you're cooking, you know, and you're preparing your own foods and you're eating a wide variety of foods, you're doing a good job of keeping, it's like, you know, really, I think people worry a little too, it's like, you know, when you're being healthy, right?
And
it's like, don't eat hamburgers every day. You know, that's not good for you. You don't eat a pound of bacon every day. You know, that's not good for you. Just like eat a variety of things, eat mostly vegetables, like all those things that I think people know and then try to like finagle their way around because they want to eat more of something else. And that's fine. Like sometimes I, but I think also people like, you know, people ask me a lot like, oh, how are you not like 300 pounds doing what you do? And it's like, well, what you see all is not necessarily what I always eat, right? It's like you see maybe like one video a week. And so you're seeing one meal out of the 20 something meals that I eat in each week. And that's not necessarily, you know, I'm not going to show you like every little salad I eat. And same, it's like on my Instagram, I go around and taste things, but it doesn't mean that like I ate, I go and order like 4 slices of pizza because I want to try 4 different types of pizza. I didn't eat all 4 of those slices of pizza all by myself all at once, right? And so, you know, generally it's like portion control, getting a good wide variety of foods. Pre-pandemic, I exercised, like I went to the gym 6 days a week, and now I don't, which is why I gained like 30 pounds through the pandemic. But in general, I think just the same advice everyone has, which is like, eat a variety of healthy foods and exercise, then you're probably fine. Your point, like salt intake, I don't feel like is your biggest concern, really.
Yeah, you're making me feel a lot better because I once made the mistake of putting a little bit of salt on some cucumbers for my daughter, my 3-year-old, and now she like will not eat cucumbers without salt.
I wish cucumbers without salt.
She is like, we go anywhere, like, she's like, did you put salt on the cucumber?
That's actually what, like, one of my earliest flavor memories I remember is like my grandmother sprinkling salt on like on cucumber slices and thinking, oh my God, like, is this so good?
All of a sudden it's delicious. Yeah. Hannah says you obviously have a lot of experience cooking, and one of the things that she's noticed in your videos is that you feel comfortable making extreme substitutions, which we creativity researchers could argue is like highly creative, but it also seems to take a lot of like, how do you feel comfortable making these substitutions? Is it a matter of like, well, you just know that X equals Y or will have the same effect? Or
it's a little of both. Like part of it is just experience and knowing that, like, you know, what fish sauce adds to a dish is pretty similar to what soy sauce adds to a dish, you know, something like that. I don't know what extreme substitutions are like, but yeah, but part of it is that. And then the other part of it is just not caring. It's like, sometimes it's like, okay, if I want to recreate that childhood dish I had, I want to recreate like my favorite dish from this restaurant and do it exactly the right way, then sure, no substitutions. Like if I want to fairly test someone's recipe, book, then sure, I'll do no substitutions. But most of the time, I don't care. It's like, I don't care if it's exactly the same as the last time I had it. I don't care if it's exactly the way my mom made it. Like, I'm going to taste it as I go. If it tastes good to me right now, then to me, that's what matters at that point, you know? And you know, so I think there's a big difference between home cooking and like restaurant. It's like at my restaurant, we have recipe books with procedures and you weigh out everything. Everything has to be exactly the same every time. Because when a customer comes in, they want the potato salad to taste exactly the same. They want the potato salad they know, right? And so in those cases, like, yeah, no substitutions. We get the same ingredients from the same suppliers. We weigh everything. We follow the exact same procedures. But home cooking, I don't think has to be that way. It's like you're cooking for yourself and your family. So just take it easy. You know, it's like do whatever you want.
Yeah.
The worst case scenario, it's like, it's very rare that you're going to mess up a dish so badly that you can't eat it. And so the worst case scenario, it's like, it's going to taste a little weird and you'll try again next time.
You know, it reminds me of one of my favorite things that David Byrne, the musician, has written in his book, How Music Works, where he laments the death of the amateur musician. And he talks about how some of the great creative leaps actually have come from amateurs because they don't care. You know, he quotes a famous film director from Spain who basically said, look, all the great directors, their masterpieces are the movies they didn't care about. That just turned out to be great because they took all these risks. And I think that's really a good lesson for a lot of us to learn. Cause like, you know, especially if you're a professional creative and there's like a lot of pressure in terms of you doing your best stuff, sometimes caring too much can come in the way of creativity. I'm pulling up this very heavy book. That's why it's not on my desk. Called The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. This is your most recent book, just came out. And I want to talk about, first of all, why it is that the wok is the tool that you reach for most often when you're cooking at home.
Well, I mean, obviously, part of it has to do with the fact that, like, I grew up in an Asian household. My mother's Japanese, my grandparents are Japanese, and I grew up with all three of them at home. And you know, Japanese was my first language. My mom cooked a lot in the wok. Anytime she deep fried, it was in the wok. So part of it is just something that I was used to. And, you know, my dad has always been obsessed with Chinese food. And so we spent a lot of time going around, you know, Boston and New York, Chinatown, and eating. So just the types of dishes that are traditionally cooked in woks are things that are particularly appealing to me. But, you know, beyond that, I just find it to be an extraordinarily versatile pan, especially for the type of cooking which I do, which is generally fast and improvisational and based on what I have. I think a wok is great for that. It's like, it's a great tool for when you go to the farmer's market or when you dig through your vegetable drawer and you have like a bunch of half used vegetables, like figuring out ways to use those. I think a wok is a great tool for doing that. But yeah, it's just versatile. It's people think of it as a tool just for stir frying, but it's the best pan in the kitchen that I can think of for deep frying. You can steam in it, you can braise in it, you can shallow fry in it, you can toss pasta in it really easily. It's like you're mentioning that video with the garlic spaghetti, but you know, when you finish pasta and you're adding pasta water and you're trying to emulsify it in a pan, like a wok is like built for tossing and stirring. So it's like great for doing stuff like that as well. So I think just the size of it and the lightweightness and the versatility makes it really useful. It's hard to say, because I don't specifically think to myself every day, like, today I'm going to choose the wok, you know, like I just find myself reaching for it. It's a pan. I've had the same wok in my kitchen for over 20 years, and I use it virtually every day, at least multiple times a week. And I just find myself reaching for like more than anything else, which is something that, you know, I talked about it in my first book in the food lab at the beginning, how there's a whole section on pots and pans at the beginning. And I wrote this big thing about the wok and how versatile and how great it is. And then there was originally a wok chapter in that book that we edited out because the book was too long, but we never edited out that bit that says like woks are amazing. So there's this whole bit that says woks are awesome and then like nothing else in the rest of the book.
Right.
So when I started writing the second volume of it, I started, again, this was like one of those things where it's like, you know, where I have the list of house chores and I just did whatever seemed easiest to me. And so I had this list of bits of this that was going to go to the second volume of the food lab. And the wok was like the part, it was like, that's the part, that's the one that I want to write, start with. And so I started writing that. Like several hundred pages in, and I hadn't gotten past like the introduction and the stir fries yet. So
yeah, no,
editor, let's make this into a whole book. And she likes the idea.
I mean, it's definitely, so the wok was one of the instruments that we actually got rid of a number of years ago because we weren't using it enough. And now we're going to have to go and buy a new one because you've convinced us that. But one of the things that I think a lot of people are thinking about now, and they're switching their gas stove for induction cooktops because it's just more environmentally friendly. And that's the one thing that there doesn't seem to be an attachment that you could, or a wok that is usable on an induction oven.
Yeah.
Is there? Okay. Yeah.
So for certain dishes, there's this flavor wok hay, like that smokiness, right? The breath of the wok that is an essential part of the dish. So in particular dishes like beef chow fun or certain types of fried rice or fried greens where you want that smoky flavor, that's really hard to get on induction or resistive coil cooktops because that relies on actual flames igniting the atomized oil and having those sort of like carcinogenic delicious things fall back into the food and that get that smoky flavor. So those dishes are hard to recreate without gas. That said, like 99% of the dishes you cook in a wok, like don't really require that flavor and can be done on induction. So you just need a flat bottom wok to work on induction. In fact, like when I was on my book tour and doing demos, I did everything on induction.
Oh, wow.
It works fine. At home, I have a gas range at home, but I've tested every recipe in the book. I've also tested on an induction cooktop. And the only ones that don't work are, those ones that require the wok hay flavor. So, you know, if you really want those flavors or you really want to, say, cook a restaurant style dish that requires a ton of high heat and a gas flame, you can either get an outdoor burner, you know, for $100 or $200 if you have the outdoor space, or you can get a camp stove, like a portable, you know, butane tank burner, which don't use them in your home unless your home is well ventilated. But if you have like a range hood that a lot of people do, even over their induction cooktops, like you can set it right on the cooktop and use the gas flame there. And just pull it out just when you want to do those specific dishes. Or if you prefer having the gas just for the wok, pull that out just for when you're using the wok. And those actually work really well. Induction cooktops. So my gas range right now, it's a relatively like high-end home range, you know, and the biggest burner on it, I think, gets out to 18,500 BTU per hour, right? Mm-hmm. A restaurant-style gas wok range will get up to around 100 to 150,000 BTU per hour, so about 10 times more. On the order of 10 times more. A induction cooktop that plugs into regular household, the 120 volt outlet, the maximum it can do is 1800 watts, which I think is the equivalent of about 6,000 to 6,500 or so BTU per hour. So it seems like it's a lot weaker than an 18,500 BTU stove, but what you have to remember is that induction is 100% efficient. So the only thing that's heating up when you put a ferrous pan on an induction cooktop is the metal itself. So you're losing almost virtually no heat to the outside air. Whereas with a gas range, especially one that's designed for a Western skillet, you know, the big burner on a gas range has a wide spread pattern because it's designed to heat up like a big 12-inch skillet evenly. So when you put a wok on it, a lot of that heat just dissipates. It goes straight up the sides, goes out to the sides of the kitchen. It heats up your kitchen. So you're actually getting, you know, comparable heat levels as far using a regular household current induction cooktop, like a normal induction cooktop, and a really powerful Western style gas burner. So in, you know, many ways they're comparable. And those little butane burners, the ones that are designed for camp stoves, if you get one that does around 15,000 BTU per hour, which is about the highest they get, there's a couple companies that make those. Iwatani is the one that I use. Those ones actually have flames that concentrate more. So they actually heat. My wok will work a lot better on like one of those, on that little dinky portable cooktop than it does on like the biggest burner on my home range. So all those things, like comparing like the numbers and then the BTU output on those things can be a little deceptive. And so people who think that their induction cooktop is not powerful enough, it is. You just have to learn how to properly preheat things and cooking batches, et cetera. All the things you would have to do with the gas range anyway.
Wow, that's really encouraging and good to know. And so we're coming up to the end of our hour, and Connie Phelps has a really interesting question. She apparently, or they apparently, conducted a molecular gastronomy Saturday enrichment camp for children.
Okay.
Which sounds like that's totally what I would sign up my kids for if I could. And they purchased your book in preparation. I'm not sure if that's the food lab or the wok or Every Night is Pizza Night, which is your children's book. I'm assuming it's the latter. But they ask, what are the top three things you would tell children about food science?
I would avoid thinking of like specific food science principles and just think more about science in general, which is that like, you know, like, so with my daughter, the way we encourage her to think about food, especially like be open to new ideas in food, is to actually do experiments. So we'll do like taste tests. So sometimes what we'll do is like, we'll ask her to like, she'll pick out five different spices from the spice drawer, or we'll pull out like three different olive oils, and we'll do taste tests, and we'll ask her to think about things critically. And so we'll taste things one at a time, ask her to use words to describe it, or we can give her like a set of like 10 words and she can pick which ones describe it. And so I think getting kids to think critically like that is just like it's just good practice in general for analytical thinking and scientific thinking. And it's really easy to apply to food because it's something you do every day. Another thing that we like to do with our daughter is when she's eating foods, you know, some kids like to disassemble and eat ingredients separately, you know, which my daughter does also. Like, you give them a sandwich, she'll eat, or like you give her a bagel with cream cheese and she'll lick all the cream cheese off first and then she'll eat the bagel. And so what we try and encourage her to do is sometimes do the opposite, where it's like, okay, she's got like a cucumber on her plate and she's got like some yogurt on her plate. All right, like eat some cucumber, eat some yogurt. Now eat them together and describe what's different when you eat them together versus separately. So again, I think just encouraging the sort of creativity and analytical thinking. And then finally, I think encouraging kids to write things down and remember things, you know, and to be open to new experiences. So it's like, if my daughter says, I don't like asparagus, right? Which sometimes she doesn't like asparagus. It's like, all right, you can remember, you don't like it. We'll ask her each day, like, what are the things that you do like? What are the things you don't like? Well, not every day, but occasionally. So she has this like list going, but what we always encourage her to do is like to remember that just because you said something today doesn't mean that it's going to apply in the future, and you can always retest it. So it's like, instead of saying, I don't like asparagus, and I guess this is not necessarily so much of a analytical thinking or a scientific principle, but just a general good eating principle, of that you can say like, I don't like asparagus, but don't say like, yuck asparagus, I don't like asparagus. But it's much better to say, I don't like asparagus today, but maybe when I'm older, I'll like it. Maybe tomorrow I'll like it. Or maybe if I try it with a different food, I'll like it. And so I think encouraging kids to have an open mind and an analytic mind and to think about what they're doing instead of just blindly doing it is like, those are all good things to think. Like, those are all things that you need to do in science, I feel like. And, you know, and I think people think of science as, a lot of people who haven't practiced science, like maybe think of it as a non-creative field, but I think you have to be extremely creative to be good at science. Like, you know, ideas don't just come from nowhere. It's not just like, science is not just blindly trying things until something works, right? It's, you have a set of ideas and you have to decide which are the ones that are likely to work. And you have to take ideas from different places and stick them together to try and come up with creative solutions for things. So I think encouraging kids to be creative in that way and think analytically and put things together is just in general, whether food or not, and whether it's just in general good training to be good at science in the future.
Yeah, we're just going to trim that clip and put it on our homepage. Thank you so much, Kenji. So if people want to learn more, if you haven't read The Food Lab, it's available booksellers everywhere, along with The Wok, Recipes and Techniques, his most recent book, and his children's book, Every Night is Pizza Night. And you can watch Kenji's cooking show, which I highly recommend, on YouTube. Kenji, thank you so much for joining us for this special crosstalk at the Society for the Neuroscience of Creativity and Inquiring Minds.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for another episode. Thanks for listening. And if you want to hear more, don't forget to subscribe. If you'd like to get an ad-free version of the show, consider supporting us at patreon.com/inquiringminds. I want to especially thank David Noel, Herring Chang, Sean Johnson, Jordan Millar, Kai Raihala, Michael Galgul, Eric Clark, Yushi Lin, Clark Lindgren, Joelle, Stefan Meyer-Awald, Dale LeMaster, and Charles Blyle. Inquiring Minds is produced by Adam Isaac. This episode was edited by Daniel Link. And I'm your host, Indre Viscontis. See you next time.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.